American Social History Podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project, Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York Graduate Center. This talk was given at the Graduate Center.
Good evening. My name is Josh Brown, and I'm Executive Director of the American Social History Project Center for Media and Learning and a member of the history faculty here at the Graduate Center. I'm pleased to welcome you this evening to the second program in a series of three public panels called Still Hazy After All These Years, marking the sesquicentennial of the start of the American Civil War. Now, it's a truism that 150 years after its start, the Civil War is still being fought, if for the most part without live ammunition. Tonight's panel is entitled The Great Divide, with a question mark, Civil War Myths and Misinformation, and we have with us a panel of distinguished historians and educators that will consider some of the many ways the history of America's greatest crisis has been excluded, overlooked, misinterpreted, and distorted in the name of commemoration and memory and, alas, learning. Our last speaker will be Jim Cullen, who is a history teacher at the Ethical Culture Fieldson School here in New York. Jim also is the book review editor, not to mention frequent and always insightful book reviewer for the indispensable online History News Network, as well as the editor of the Common School column for the equally indispensable website Commonplace, the interactive journal of early American life. A PhD in American Civilization from Brown University, Jim's many publications include The Civil War in Popular Culture, A Reusable Past, The Art of Democracy, A Concise History of Popular Culture in the United States, which has gone through a number of editions, and which I must say I had the fortune of reviewing a number of years ago, and American Dream, A Short History of an Idea that Shaped a Nation, and Born in the USA, Bruce Springsteen and the American Tradition.
Okay, I have some prefatory remarks that I think I'm going to shelve and maybe save them for the discussion part of our panel here. So I'm going to proceed directly to showing a clip showing a clip here from Gangs of New York. This is a movie I assume many people in this audience have seen maybe more than once. And I'll just say that I have sort of a career-long interest in the way history is done by people who aren't historians. And what I find interesting about this clip in particular is the way in which there's a kind of, especially the way that it culminates. I mean, there's a whole version of the Civil War silently enacted by Martin Scorsese's camera that tells us what happened. And we can argue with that, and we can factually contest that, but it's coherent and very powerful. So let me just, let's just show it, and we'll take things from there.
That's the building of our country right there, Mr. Cutting. Americans are born here.
I don't see no Americans. I see trespassers. Irish hawks do a job for a nickel what a nigger does for a dime, and a white man used to get a quarter for. What have they done? Name one thing they've contributed. Votes. Votes, you say? They vote how the Archbishop tells them, and who tells the Archbishop? Their king in a pointy hat, but sits on his throne in Rome.
Bill's got mixed feelings as regards the Irish.
Bill, deliver these good and fervent folk to the polls on a regular basis, and there'll be a handsome price for each vote goes Tammany's way.
My father gave his life making this country what it is. Murdered by the British with all of his men on the 25th of July, Anno Domini 1814. You think I'm gonna help you befoul his legacy? By giving this country over to them must have no hand in the fighting for it. Why, because they come off a boat crawling with lice and begging you for soup?
You're a great one for the fighting, Bill, I know. But you can't fight forever.
I can go down doing it.
And you will.
What did you say?
I said you're turning your back on the future.
Not our future.
That document makes you a citizen. This one makes you a private in the Union Army. Now go fight for your country. Next. 9 years, sir. Four make you, Mark.
We were thinking when we got to Yankee Man, shoved a gun into our hands. Saying, Paddy, you must go and fight for Lincoln.
Mr. Muskin, make sure you keep it dry on the cold.
We were going.
I heard Tennessee.
Where's that?
There is nothing here but war, where the murdering cannons roar. And I wish I was at home in dear old Dublin.
Do they fear us now, do you think?
picture's worth a million words, I guess. I'll just say again, to try to jump right in here, that my current project, which has clear roots in the work I've been doing all along, it has the working title, Sensing the Past, Hollywood Actors as Historians. My goal this time is less to look at the interpretive dimensions of a single document and what it says about a historical event, but rather how the choices of a movie star suggest an incipient historiography about U.S. history as a whole. Now, movie star is actually crucial here, because only the biggest names exercise the kind of leverage that allows them to choose projects over time that can let them fashion something resembling an ideologically consistent body of work. That's the difference between a star and, say, an actor. It is through the choice of roles and patterns of logic and the behavior of the characters these stars portray that one can discern priorities, values, and what might be termed a kind of collective common sense. So just to illustrate this, you know, outside the immediate frame of reference, take someone like Denzel Washington. I'll be brief here and say that to a remarkable degree, Washington's work pivots around relationships between literal and figurative fathers and children, suggesting a familial vision of social progress that runs from Glory, where he prays a prodigal son redeemed by the surrogate father played by Morgan Freeman, to a movie like The Great Debaters, where competing father figures help forge the character of James Farmer Jr., the founder of CORE, and a pivotal figure among the freedom fighters of the Civil Rights Movement. I think that many of these people in the audience are familiar with the concept of Republican motherhood. Denzel Washington, in his body of work, gives us a vision of Republican fatherhood, and that this is how social change happens. That's one example. Now, to the matter at hand, for our purposes today, the relevant figure is Daniel Day-Lewis. Day-Lewis is legendary for his chameleon-like capacity to embody wildly different characters. But I think there's a thread that connects his characters, and the key trope is the concept of the frontier as elucidated by Frederick Jackson Turner. Now, this is not really the time or place to unpack this in great detail, maybe later. But if you apply this concept to movies where you wouldn't normally think about it, a certain logic emerges. So, for example, you take Daniel Day-Lewis's movie, The Crucible. I see it here as a frontier story, thanks to Mary Beth Norton, who in The Devil's Snare makes the case that the Salem witch trials can be understood as a story of frontier stresses. And in fact, I think that Daniel Day-Lewis is the iconography of Daniel Day-Lewis in a movie like The Crucible is much more that of a Western frontiersman even than in Arthur Miller's play. Miller wrote the screenplay for the movie, so there's no desecration there. I think there's just a kind of reposition that takes place. The most obvious case of this, of course, is Day-Lewis's movie Last of the Mohicans. This is a frontier story and that hardly needs any elaboration in terms of a reconfiguration of the James Fenimore Cooper novel, one, of course, that Cooper's novel could use some reconfigurations, and it certainly served for modern-day purposes. Now, what I'd like to suggest here today is that Gangs of New York is also a frontier tale. This may seem counterintuitive, but historians ranging from William Cronin to Luke Sontag have talked about cities, New York City in particular, in these terms. Viewed from this standpoint, the waves of Irish immigrants in the story are like the townspeople crowding in the hunters and trappers represented by the native gangs who control downtown. Now, nominally, the plot of Gangs of New York concerns Amsterdam Valens, Leonardo DiCaprio's, loss of father in a gang fight in 1846 and his return after 16 years of reform school to kill the butcher, only to fall under his sway and become a virtual son. This patricidal struggle takes place against the backdrop of a fratricidal one, the Civil War, which engulfs New York in the form of the draft riots of 1863, a five-day episode of urban anarchy that would only be quelled with the arrival of troops returning from Gettysburg. But it becomes clear that dreamboat-like DiCaprio notwithstanding, the movie belongs to Daniel Day-Lewis, his Bill the Butcher. There's something appropriately ironic that the butcher's name goes by the name of the Native Americans. The term is historically accurate in denoting what was at the time a growing number of U.S. citizens who were increasingly hostile to the rising tide of immigrants, especially Irish immigrants, that would culminate with the American, or AKA Know-Nothing Party in the 1850s, which would prove to be a temporary but powerful force in U.S. politics. But of course, in our day, the phrase Native American is considered a politically correct term for Indian. Though a gleeful racist who regards anyone who is not a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant as a real American, who doesn't regard him as a real American, the butcher's situation in Gangs of New York resembles no one more aptly than a Delaware sachem confronted with growing numbers of outside interlopers and deciding to take a stand against them. On that day in 1846, the butcher and his natives prevail despite the enemy's greater numbers. But as we sense, he's only bought time. He can manage, even absorb, the steady stream of new arrivals for an interval. Indeed, it's one of the paradoxes of the butcher's character that he can employ his former enemies and even tease them affectionately about their ethnic foibles. But like a Hydra-headed monster, Valens' legacy returns in the form of his son, whose ironically Teutonic name, Amsterdam, will ultimately challenge the Butcher for supremacy. In the meantime, however, the unwitting chief takes a shine to the kid and nurtures him in the ways of tribal power. As such, he's like a triumphant Indian warrior who incorporates the kin of vanquished foes into his clan. Over the course of the almost three-hour movie, Amsterdam will grow sufficient strength to reassert his true patrimony. But only the overwhelming forces, the only overwhelming forces that Bill Cutting faces do not come from knives or even guns, but from the mortal threat of votes and the overwhelming force that they can ultimately impose on those who control them. The first person to realize this, naturally, is Boss Tweed, played by Jim Broadbent, who presides over at Tammany Hall, whose very name invokes the sachem immortalized in Last of the Mohicans. Tweed starts out as an eager collaborator with the Butcher, but comes to see him as an obstacle to consolidating his power. Instead, Tweed turns his attention to the new arrivals, who will be the shock troops of a renovated Democratic Party. There's the building of the country right there, Bill. Americans are burning, Tweed says, the scene we just saw. The Butcher's reply, of course, is, I don't see Americans, I see trespassers. When, about two-thirds of the way through the movie, the Butcher learns the true identity of his protege, he turns on him with ferocity. That strongly suggests a fatalistic death wish. In a scene more shocking than any gang fight, he murders Valens' Irish mentor, Monk, played by Brendan Gleeson, who has been elected sheriff on a Tammany ticket in broad daylight. See if his ashes burn green, he says to the horrified lookers, after throwing a knife into the conciliatory Monk's back, a move reminiscent of a tomahawk throw, and bashing his head with the very club Monk used in his own gang-banging days. The film closes a circle when Valens challenges the Butcher to a gang fight. The two sides meet to discuss conditions, and the Butcher is pleased that they will eschew the use of guns. Good boy, he tells Valens. There's a sarcasm here, but an implicit compliment that in honoring, quote, the ancient laws of combat, an erstwhile adoptive father is complimenting his enemy's biological son for having grown into a worthy opponent. By the time Valens and the Butcher have their climactic confrontation, however, their blood feud is beside the point, for it is taking place against the backdrop of a much larger one. At the very moment of their fight, the city is engulfed by the draft riots, a mass protest against conscription by the working classes and the power of the state, which responded with a massive show of federal force in the form of the Union Army, which, for so long seemingly irrelevant, finally becomes the real enemy of the gangs of New York. The Civil War is traditionally represented as the triumph of the federal government over a feudal plantation elite. Here we see that it's not only slaveholding Southerners who are steamrolled by the power of the national state, but a local subculture as well. In The Significance of the Frontier in American History, Frederick Jackson Turner depicted the power of the national state as an implacable but largely benign force that stitches the nation together. Here it's a terrible swift sword that slices existing growth to make room for a new society. Gangs of New York represents a transposition of roles for Daniel Day-Lewis. In Last of the Mohicans, he was Hawkeye. This time, he's Chingachgook. Like generations of dime novel readers and fans of Westerns, we admire him in his savagery, which has a kind of nobility, even as is unacceptable as a basis for contemporary society. As with the Indians of the frontier, Bill the Butcher must die so that we, a non-WASP multiracial majority, might live. It's Leonardo DiCaprio, Valens, who represents the synthesis of cultures who will survive as a hardy hybrid and make a modern America. The problem is that one is haunted by a perception that he's a lesser man. But in his savage nobility, Gangs of New York leaves us with an implicit assertion, the savage nobility of Bill the Butcher, an implicit assertion that our national elites view the older white working class as settlers who need to be removed to create a modern multicultural nation. Would we care to deny it? I'll be interested to hear what you have to say.